Welcome to MIT Talks. I'm Vita Bilkis.
And I'm Dana Attar. MIT Talks set out to bring you the stories that shape the people of MIT.
And I'm Sarah Trace. As the co-hosts of MIT Talks, we go behind the scenes with some of the most influential members of the MIT community, past and present, to dig deeper into their unique and inspiring journeys.
So tune in, listen, learn, and grow.
This is MIT Talks.
I think from an environmental lens, we are on a massively destructive path, and I would just love to see us bring together everybody to come together to make some serious investments and sacrifices to change that.
Hello, I'm Vita Bilkis, your host for today's episode of MIT Talks. Today's guest, Air Muir, is the founder of Clover Food Labs, a vegetarian fast casual food chain in Massachusetts. Air is a proud alum of MIT and holds a bachelor's and master's in material science and engineering. On this podcast, we chat about his inspiring story from running labs at MIT to becoming a leading food entrepreneur in Boston. Hear how a mission-driven purpose drives a fulfilling business and life. I know you will enjoy our chat just as much as I did. Welcome to the show, Air. I have to admit, being a vegetarian and living in Boston, I'm a pretty big fan of Clover Food Labs, and I'm very much looking forward to our chat and hearing about your journey. So I'm curious, and I'm sure that our listeners are too, how does a guy with a bachelor's and master's in material science from MIT come to be the founder and CEO of a healthy fast food company? You know, I read something on your website that said in 2007, you read that the meat industry is the number three contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And 12 months later, you opened a food truck. I mean, in 2008, you were truly your first in Boston, both in bringing vegetarian food to the masses and then doing it from a food truck. I mean, I don't even think there were any food trucks before you started out. So could you share with our listeners what those first few months were like for you and kind of how you got to that point of deciding to pursue this journey?
Yeah, well, I'm really happy to talk to you. And we've been at this for a little while. You know, as you mentioned, got started in 2008. I've thought of myself as an environmentalist for a long time, but I had no experience in the food industry. And, you know, if you talked to me in 2007, I didn't think of food as having anything to do with the environment. So I read an article, essentially the results of a study by the UN and FAO called Livestock's Long Shadow. And somebody had shared it with me. And it was one of the first major studies to lay out the impacts of the livestock industry on CO2 emissions and other greenhouse gases. And I was in disbelief when I read it. I thought that the things you could do to help with global warming had to do with building green buildings and moving to electric cars and building windmill farms. And I just never thought of food as part of that list. I never heard it described that way. And you know, I'm an engineer by training, and I started digging into it a little bit. And the more I learned, the more I started thinking this is not just sort of interesting and opportunity, but probably as a society, if we're really going to move from where we are right now, which is like headed on a disastrous track, to a different place where we're starting to address, you know, and even like change our trajectory and starting to reduce or even reverse global warming, food is going to have to be a part of that. And unlike these other fields I mentioned, there is not a lot of money being spent by governments to change food systems. There's not a lot of money being spent by institutions, by nonprofits. And it's a very unique space in that way. There's massive investment in green energy. There's massive investment in green buildings. There's massive investment in green transportation and almost no investment in changing our food system. Although, you know, most estimates suggest that there's more greenhouse gas emissions from the livestock industry than all of transportation combined. So that was it was a big awakening for me. And at the time I was working at McKinsey & Company as a consultant, and I was looking to move to my next thing, and I didn't know what it would be, but I was thinking of wind farms, actually. And then I read about this and I started to think, what would it take? You know, if I know that this is true, what could be done here? And I started thinking, you know, wondering if you could make a restaurant company that is focused on you know, not taking people who've already committed to eat without meat in their diet, but people who love eating meat, and get them to substitute a couple meals a month. I mean, initially our goal was like one or two meals a month. So you're not trying to transform someone's entire lifestyle, but rather trying to swap out a meal or two. And that was the idea behind Clover. And I wasn't sure it would work. The reason we started with a food truck is I was doubtful that there was going to be a path. And I think even today, you know, so Clover has no meat on our menu, but 90% of our customers are not vegetarian. And they're really, as far as I know, there aren't any other restaurants that you could describe the same way. There are obviously a lot more plant-based restaurants than there used to be, which I am applauding and I think is fantastic. But most of those, substantial, if not majority of their audience, are people who are plant-based every day. And so we're very unusual in that we're serving meat-free meals to people who otherwise love eating meat. And that's what we've been working on. That's our mission.
So that first food truck, did you work on that first food truck or did you have others helping you? And how was that experience?
For the first 2.5 or 3 years, I was loading the food truck at 4:30, 5 a.m. And I was making the food and breaking it all down at the end of the day and putting it away at, you know, doing prep for the next day and finishing up at 10:30, 11 p.m. And that was a good thing. I was a little younger back then, but that was my schedule for a couple of years. Sunday nights, we would do prep for the week. And I had, you know, in those early days, I had some staff that would come in at noon, like in the middle of the day, to help run the busiest part of the day. I mean, at the very start, there'd been a moratorium on food trucks in Boston and Cambridge for a long time. And frankly, I think that the rules that Boston has had about this tie into some underlying racism and sort of discriminatory in a way. But I think that there have been very strict rules governing how food can be sold on the street. And as a result, in Cambridge, there were just a couple, there were some food trucks, but not a lot. So there were two on Mass Ave by MIT at 77 Mass Ave. And then there were six food trucks that were, they were actually all parked outside of a building that was demolished. And then they'd gotten moved by the time I was doing this over near the medical center. And then there were a couple others scattered around Cambridge, but the total number was pretty small. And most of the quote unquote food trucks that were in operation were canteen trucks, so the ones that pull up to construction sites. So there were trucks around, but there hadn't been any new trucks in a very long time because of these rules. And I actually approached a guy who operated a food truck at 77 Mass Ave named Batruce, and I had eaten from him a lot when I was an undergrad. I lived at Bexley Hall, which doesn't exist anymore, but was right there across the street. And he sold falafel soda baklava combo for $2.50. So
can't beat that.
You couldn't beat that. And I made that dinner a lot. And so he knew me. And so I approached him and said, hey, would you sell my food? Instead of doing a focus group, I'd like to just sell to 15, 20 meals a day. And I could interview people each day, figure out if they like what I'm making or not. And he said, absolutely not. And I'm like, I'll pay you a lot of money. And he said, no. And he said, but you should open your own truck. And he told me about a guy he thought was good for nothing who wasn't showing up, who he didn't like, who was over, who had one of the other grandfather spots, but wasn't showing up. So he said, I should look and see if I can get that spot. And I didn't really want to do that. But then a month later, it ended up sort of coming together and we ended up starting out that way. And so we were like the first new truck. And then a couple months after we started, a food truck out in LA called Koji had hired a PR firm and like all of a sudden was getting written up. And it was like, this was a downturn. So the story leads were like, you know, in this economy, like, you know, here's an inexpensive way chefs can do creative things with food. And all of a sudden we got swept up in that and we were, you know, Wall Street Journal was writing an article of the top 10 food trucks in the country and we were on their list. And it was sort of, it was like this sort of unexpected thing that happened early on for Clover and was a nice launching point.
Definitely. And when did you open your first location?
So that was a few years later. We opened the first restaurant in Harvard Square in very end of 2011. So going into 2012. So we're like 9 years into the restaurant business.
So tell me a little bit more for our listeners who may not be familiar with your restaurants. You know, what is the concept and mission of Clover Food Labs and how many locations do you have now and kind of where do you think the future of Clover is going?
Yeah, so we are, I'm I'm sitting right now in a restaurant that we're opening on Friday this week, and this will be our 13th restaurant. All of our restaurants right now are based in the Boston area. At one point, we were operating 8 food trucks that would all go out every day, but we don't do that any longer. And so we still have 2 that we use for catering and events, but we don't have any daily food truck operations. So it's all shifted to restaurants now. Our restaurants are, they'd be categorized as fast casual. So we try to get your food relatively quickly, and the price points are pretty affordable. We're open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. A breakfast may be $3 to $5. Lunch might be $10 or $12. And, probably one of the most distinctive things about Clover, especially if you know anything about the food business or if you're an insider, is that the menu changes all the time. So we found, that early challenge, how do I get somebody who loves eating meat to come eat at Clover? I need them to prefer what I'm selling. And, I could make it way cheaper. That might sway some people. I could make it much more convenient. That may sway people. But the path we ended up focusing on is making things really delicious. And so for our customers, they need to walk past a fried chicken place. They need to walk past a burrito shop. They need to walk past a salad or bowl joint. And they need to come to Clover because they want to eat what we have. It's more delicious. And, we found early on the key to unlocking that and getting people to really dream about vegetables was serving them vegetables that are at their peak. My most popular sandwich I sell all year is a Brussels sprout sandwich. And it's a beautiful sandwich. And it's got like a smoked cheddar cheese, and it has like a mustard aioli. And then it has these Brussels sprouts that are like beautiful and fragrant. They get a little bit of like a truffle-like smell.
You're making me hungry, Air.
it's really yummy. It has some hazelnuts, and it has a little bit of pickled red cabbage on it, sort of a play on, cabbage and cabbage. And the sandwich overall is just like fantastic. It's our best-selling sandwich we have all year, but we only sell it when the Brussels sprouts are at their peak. And that's like when the autumn gets cold enough at night. And so it's maybe 3 to 6 weeks a year. Obviously, I could buy Brussels sprouts any time of the year and sell the sandwich, but it wouldn't taste as good. And, I think over time, it wouldn't remain the most popular sandwich we had. So we have this discipline where we sell things when they're really at their best. And so we'll sell the Brussels sprout sandwich in October, but right now we're selling a sandwich that features young fennel. And a month or two ago, I was selling a sandwich that featured carrots. We're using the last of the storage carrots. And the menu reflects what's available at any given time. So as a result, the menu changed a lot. And this is really, really unusual for the restaurant industry. I'm to the point where I don't know if there's anybody who has a menu that rotates the way ours does.
Yeah, I was just going to say that is very, very unusual, I think, and probably demanding on your operations and does make things a little more complicated.
Yeah, I think probably the closest thing is like a very small, owner-operated fine dining restaurant where the chef is the owner and picks what they want to make each night. But at scale, we're unique. We've built a lot of technology to enable this and to let us do this in a really graceful way. It's not something we would be able to do without the tech. And it's taken a lot of years to get good at it. But at this point, this is something we're really good at doing. And it's a lot of fun to be able to introduce people to vegetables they've never had or vegetables they thought they didn't like because they've had really lousy versions. And now we give them something that's beautiful and memorable and they can't wait to try again.
Are more restaurants in the future of Clover? Is that where you want to go with opening more locations, or do you have a little bit of a slight different vision for it?
Yeah, we're constructing 2 more right now. I'd like to get to 30 or 40 in Boston. So we're, not quite halfway there. And then we would also like to open in other regions as well. We want to be careful with our growth. I think we survived this pandemic because we've done a good job with that. I think there are decisions we could have made a couple of years ago, which, if we had grown more aggressively or taken a lot of money from a private equity firm or something, we may have been in a more delicate position. Sadly, Bike Chloe went bankrupt really early in the pandemic. And I think, a number of others are in a really tough spot as well. So we're trying to grow in a smart way that, allows us to be stable and continue for a long time. But we are also at the same time really aggressive about the growth because the more people we serve, the more good we're doing. So it's our mission really to expand this as much as we can.
Really mission driven. I love that. And sounds like very strong roots here. So that's awesome. So you know, I think I see on your hand, because we're doing this on Zoom, a MIT ring. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yes. Yep,
so maybe we'll rewind a little bit. You know, how did you get to MIT and why did you pursue the degrees you did? Maybe you could just share a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I went to MIT for undergrad and I got my bachelor's degree in 2000. And my degree was in material science and engineering. And then I ended up getting a master's degree as well, but it barely feels real to me because by the time I graduated as an undergrad, I had most all of what I needed for the master's just because of the classes I was interested in. And my advisor pointed that out to me. So I ended up being a teacher's assistant for a couple semesters and I wrote a thesis and I got my master's. So I didn't do a lot for that. And that was in 2001, but I loved MIT and had a terrific time.
Where did you grow up? Like, how did you decide that MIT was the place for you? Is that something you had always wanted or?
I grew up in Western Mass and, you know, I don't know. I think that probably most of the people who went to high school with me were pretty surprised. I think people thought of me more as a liberal arts person. And I liked a lot of liberal arts stuff. But, you know, I think quietly I was really good at and interested in science and math too. So I was probably less what my reputation was in high school, but I had a deep interest in that. And I don't know, I mean, this is going way back, but I do remember I applied to MIT. I got in early, but I wasn't sure it was the right choice. And I remember like it was coming down, like there was a day I had to like, if this is a long time ago, but you had to accept by mail and your like letter had to be postmarked on a certain date. And I was in the post office at like 3:30 p.m., you know, on the day where I had to send a decision. And I had actually had the letter for Stanford and the letter for MIT in my hand. And it was it was down to like the last moment to decide. But I think I felt like MIT was a school that like you don't get to graduate from unless you've worked really hard. And I put in effort and learned a lot. And, you know, I think I wanted that. And I also, I really... You know, I look at science and math as sort of the pursuit of understanding like the world around us and how it works and how it came to be. So and that's something that I, you know, plan to do in college, and what better place to do it than MIT. And my favorite band in the world was based in Cambridge at the time.
Who's
so
that?
So that had a little bit of an influence on this as well. It was a band called Morphine.
Okay, yeah.
And I liked music a lot, and I was pretty excited to be in the town that Morphine played.
So we have Morphine to thank for you being an alum of MIT and not Stanford.
Yeah.
So, you know, you take a very personal approach to your branding for Clover with blog posts written from you, starting, you know, very much from the early days. It's almost like a diary of sorts. It reads like that. How did this come about and how has this personal touch translated into your culture? And how do you balance that now personal storytelling time with running what is a very fast growing company?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, at the very beginning, like I said, I didn't really think this would work, which is why we did the food truck. So I think I thought at that time, well, this would be a fun period in my life to have like well documented as like a journal or diary. So it really was that in the very beginning. And blogs were just becoming a thing in 2008. And so some of the technology was available to, you know, sort of easily keep track of what you're doing day to day. And so it really was like a digital journal. And everything at Clover has been built from the ground up to be very transparent. So it just made sense to like make this sort of personal journal available to everyone to see. And I think that affected the tone, which had a big impact on our early days because, you know, we designed the, like, even when we were doing food truck, we cut the whole side of it open. We were really the first operator in the country to do that. It became a style that was mimicked by others later. But up until Clover, food trucks had a little teeny window slit. And, you know, it was designed so you wouldn't really see in there very much because you didn't want to. And we were very radical in cutting up the whole side of our truck. The health department even gave me a hard time about it. They're like, people, you don't want to show people what's happening in there. And I said, yes, we do. But, you know, we wanted to make everything transparent and let people see what we're doing, good and bad. And that made sense to carry that through to, you know, my journey and story. You know, we keep that up. I think to your question about how does that translate now, you know, I don't think I spend as much time as I would like to writing posts and things. I do it, but not as often as I once did. I mean, in those early days, I would write things two or three times a day. And now I write something maybe a couple times a month. And, you know, maybe at some point, there'll be enough people doing a job for me that I can adjust that. But it's, you know, it's hard to keep it up. It's a lot of fun to write, but it does take some time to get in that state of mind. And I think that that's probably the hardest thing right now is like all through the day, I'm responsible for so many different things and there's a lot going on. You know, this past year we had to get through COVID, you know, I had to figure out what that meant for financing the company and what it meant for negotiating with landlords and what it meant for, you know, our employees. And then we've also built a new business, which is a direct to consumer. So we send meal boxes, meal kits to people's homes. And that business has been on fire, just sort of doubling every quarter. It's now, you know, I think it's at about a quarter of our total company in terms of its scale.
And is that just to Massachusetts residents or anywhere?
Yeah. So we deliver ourselves with our own refrigerated vehicles. So it's, we go out, it's sort of out to 495, basically out around Boston. And it's a lot of fun. And if anybody's in that range and hasn't tried these, give them a whirl and then give us some honest feedback. But generally, people are really excited. We try to be very generous and the food is really beautiful. For the meal boxes, like I tried all Blue Apron and all those, and I thought a lot of them took a lot of time and created a lot of mess. And they're often more fussy recipes than I would make at home. And then takeout, we all know what that is, but it leaves something wanting. And at restaurants, every day we have a lot of food that's been prepared to precursors to your meal so that when someone comes in, we can make them a really delicious meal in 5 minutes or so. And that's true for fine dining restaurants too. So I thought, what if we prepare meal kits that are like that? Like a lot of the heavy lifting's been done, but they're still requiring you to do a little bit of assembly at the end. And so that's the goal of it. We're trying to sell it at a price point that competes with grocery shopping, but it's a lot less work for you at the end. And also in many cases, maybe ingredients you wouldn't have tried or know how to use. And certainly ingredients that are qualities higher than you could otherwise source, because the way we source clover is just very different than the way a grocery store sources. And the quality of what you're going to get is like much, much higher quality. So that's sort of the idea of it. So we built that business. And then I am actually spinning off our tech business right now. And we're dealing with expansion plans. So there's a lot going on. So at any given moment, my day is switching from a meeting about marketing, to a meeting about finance, to a meeting about a new store opening, to a meeting about, you know, some construction designs. And I think that in that reality, it's a lot harder to find those moments to sort of sit back and write something than it used to be in the beginning, where my life was more simple. I worked very hard, but it was like, you know, much more straightforward in a way.
Well, you definitely feel that connection, though. Like I said, those strong roots from the beginning that have carried through your brand. It's really quite impressive. So just sharing a little bit more about, you know, your entrepreneurial journey. I also read that you got your MBA at Harvard and then, you know, you mentioned your McKinsey stint. Do you think there was this defining moment? You know, we talked a little bit about your inspiration to start perhaps this food company, but to go off, you know, and make the decision to be an entrepreneur, I think is a commitment, so to speak. Do you have sort of a clear definition of what that moment was for you and what or who were some of those things that inspired you to really take that leap?
Yeah, I think I had a sense for a long time that I would be an entrepreneur someday. Yeah, I don't know why I expected that, but I just had a sense I would start business or more than one. But, you know, for me, I think some people do that when they're 14, you know, and for some people, like, that works really, really well. I think I'm probably a little more cautious and I have to sort of learn and observe. So for me, it came a little later in my career. You know, as mentioned, I had been at MIT. When I left MIT, I was working as a research scientist running a laboratory. And then I went back to school to get my MBA and worked for Patagonia, the clothing company, before I ended up at McKinsey & Company. And, you know, it was really, I think, a combination of all that that got me to a spot where I felt the confidence and excitement to, you know, to launch a company and sort of try that next chapter. But I think that this is something, obviously, it's very personal and each person has sort of like a moment that might be right. And for many, you know, that doesn't even happen. It takes a lot to build something, you know, as you know, it's a lot of personal sacrifice. And I have a great deal of respect for any founder. There's a lot that's not seen by everybody that goes into building the business. And it's a wonderful path. I feel very fortunate to be doing what I do each day. But, you know, without a question, there's a lot I've given in order to be here.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. Well, you know, given that you were, you know, in charge of the lab and doing research in a lab, I find it so interesting that you named your company Clover Food Lab and that you do a lot of innovative and what, you know, it seems like trial and experimentation. Like you have these Taco Tuesdays you were telling us, you know, about the meal kits. And then you do really interesting marketing things like pay, I think, what you want at Newtonville when you first open. And so how does that experimentation, you know, play in how you build your business? And sounds like a very MIT approach, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. When I was at business school, it was like, it just struck me like, yeah, I guess business school and the McKinsey after. So few businesses really experiment with anything. You know, I think that businesses sometimes have things they call experiments, but they're really more like tests, which aren't the same thing. And I think to be experimenting, you have to be open to various outcomes. You know, you have to be excited to see something succeed or fail and prepared for that. And I think often what businesses do is a more of a test where their expectation is a certain outcome and they feel frustrated if it's not that outcome. You know, there might be a lot more experimentation in the tech industry, but I think broadly speaking, it's not something businesses do very often or very well. And so I think, you know, as a, when you start your own business, you can do what you want, good or bad. And this was a point of view I brought to Clover, and I thought, you know, why don't we embrace experimentation and why don't we experiment on product development to figure out our menu, but also experiment with other things, you know, the policies we have for our employees, you know, the way we operate our restaurants. And so we have sort of continued to do that over time, you know, and as a result, we have a lot of things that we fail at, you know, it's, but I think that those failures are great because they're an opportunity to learn as long as you can keep the cost down.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you touched on this a little bit, you know, that restaurants were so badly affected during the pandemic. And, you know, here in Massachusetts, I'm curious what you thought when you heard, you know, we are shutting down. What were some of those initial thoughts? And what were some of your first immediate moves to do to sort of control the damage, so to speak?
I had been expecting it by the time it came along. But it certainly was a lot to process. And, you know, I think I had the same fears most restaurateurs had, which is, you know, am I going to lose what I've spent all this time building? And immediately, I mean, this is a people business. So I was thinking a lot about what does this mean for my staff and my employees. Clover shut down right when the state did. And then we opened up months after that. So we laid off all our employees, including me and, you know, my senior team. But I, at that point in time, we didn't really know much. And I just felt like the state would allow us to operate in a takeout capacity, but I didn't feel like we knew enough to do that safely. And in fact, most of the restaurants I know who stayed open during that period had multiple outbreaks in the restaurants. So I think we made a good choice, but it was definitely a hard choice to make. And I think we resolved ourselves to not just set a path to survive the pandemic, but try to come out the other side as a more valuable company than we were going in. So I think that's been a big focus for us, is not just to get through to the other side of this, but also, but to actually build some value. And it's been a lot of hard work to achieve that, but I think that's actually the way things look to us right now, is we're coming out of this really a stronger company and in better shape than we were going in.
That's so great. Congratulations. That's a lot of adjustment and pivoting and experimenting, I'm sure. So that's really commendable. I loved one of your recent Clover newsletters, and the subject line was, "I don't want things to return to the way they were, do you?" And essentially it asked us to reflect on returning to normal after the pandemic, and if that idea of going back to normal is truly what we want, or if a better future is possible. And I totally agree. I think we're in this very unique place in history where we could, you know, design a different world and design a totally different quote unquote normal, or what that looks like. So I'm just curious, do you have some thoughts about what that different possibility would look like?
Yeah, I think that there are so many opportunities for us to do things better that it would be a shame for anybody to spend each day hoping we can get back to a place we once were. I think from an environmental lens, we are on a massively destructive path. And I would just love to see us bring together everybody to come together to make some serious investments and sacrifices to change that. And I mean, the kinds of things I'm thinking about is, I don't know why Massachusetts public schools serve any meat. And at the very least, why not have a meatless Monday? You know, my daughter's high school has zero vegetarian options on the menu 5 days a week. And these are taxpayer dollars. And we know without a doubt that those are choices that are, you know, worsening the situation of global warming. And I would love to see those kinds of things change. You know, single-use containers are a complete nightmare. We know that they've been dumped into the oceans, and we know that less than 10% of all plastic ever made has been recycled. You know, recycling is factually a lie. 90% of what is made of plastic is not recycled. Glass is a bad situation. Aluminum is a bad situation. And yet we've sort of built an economy that depends on those disposables. That's not the way things have always been. And obviously there's another path. So from an environmental standpoint, I would love to see us change the way we're doing things. Stepping back, that's not the only lens we can take. I think a lot of people have been rightly focused on the way that underrepresented communities experience our society. And I think that's been shown in the Black Lives Matter movement, but there's also Stop Asian Hate, and there's a number of other things that we can be doing to make sure we have a more equitable society. So I would love to see us change the way we're sort of shaping and building our society when it comes to that as well. And I think the restaurant industry has a really immediate role in that. You know, the restaurant industry has been lobbying for years to keep the tipped wage in place. This is a system that has direct, well-documented roots to post-slavery. You know, tipped wages were created as a way to pay former slaves without really paying them. And it's absurd, I think, that we operate this way. But the restaurant industry depends on that. We have massive segregation in the restaurant industry. Most restaurants rely on a segregated front of house versus back of house. And the tipping rules and laws that we have to follow reflect those expectations. We're not allowed to give tips to back of house employees by law. And so there are a lot of structures, I think, that we really should be rethinking right now. And, you know, I can't do that alone. I'm hoping others are with me. And I'm hoping that we are reopening into a new moment where there's more momentum to question some of these things and make some of that change happen more quickly.
Yeah, it does seem, you know, at least that this generation coming up has maybe its sights on something a little bit better, right? Let's hope and let's support them and do our part, like you're saying. So I'm just curious, you know, as a busy entrepreneur, do you have any sort of well-being habits or non-negotiables you have, you know, held on to throughout this crazy ride, or anything that served you?
I care a lot about sleep. I like to get 8 or 9 hours a night, and I usually do. So I guess that's maybe something that structured my life a little bit. I don't work at all on the weekends. At the start of Clover, I did, and I think it was a mistake because I thought the restaurant business is 7 days, so it doesn't matter. I could take a Monday off or a Thursday off. But I found for my family, that was really a disaster because they could never count on when I would be available and around. So I ended up shifting to a schedule where I don't take phone calls. I just don't do anything on Saturday and Sunday. And it's fine. I mean, I think in general, you maybe need to make decisions about what you need to do and then let your company and your colleagues and your investors and everything else sort of form around you. But if you don't take a stand and be clear about what you need, I think it's hard. You're just shifting and moving all the time. So, I think probably the biggest recommendation would be to figure out whether you know ahead of time or you experiment until you get the right combination of things, but just set up your limits and boundaries and trust that everything will reform and reshape around those.
That's a great tip. I love it. So, you know, wrapping up, can you give us a call to action, this extended MIT community and our listeners? You know, what would be a call to action that you'd like us to leave with and be inspired by that we can maybe support?
Yeah, well, I think I can make one that's really direct to MIT. MIT is engaging in a really massive effort to address global warming and environmental issues. And it's my opinion that food should be at the very top of that. And I think right now it's barely mentioned. So I think that, you know, if you have interest in this already and you're already knowledgeable about it, I think, you know, you can sort of join the growing voices to try to bring more attention to the opportunity we have to change the way we eat. If it's new to you, do a little research till you can get yourself to the point of feeling passionate about this. And in either case, I think we can probably, you know, I've written some letters to some of the folks involved in those committees. And I think the more that they hear, the better. I'm, you know, very directly, MIT could change education for their own students about what kind of foods they can eat and change the options that students have. But I think more broad than that, obviously, MIT has a lot of impact on research. And I think some of that focus could be on creating alternatives to how we produce and eat food. So I'd love to see food come to the top of the climate agenda, because I think that it will help us get to where we want to go faster.
Awesome call to action. So we have these MIT Talk signature questions at the end we ask each of our guests. So the first one is, what is one book you think everyone should read?
I don't know if I can answer that very well. I love reading books, but I think that they're so personal, what you enjoy and get something out of. So I'm not sure I can pick one that I think would be great for everybody.
All right, yeah. You're gonna pass. Okay, the next question. Please use one word to describe your past, your present, and your future. So three different words, one for your past, one for your present, one for your future.
I guess, you know, for my past, I might say lucky. For the present, I might say hopeful. The future, I don't know. It's hard for me to know what's ahead, I guess.
You'll stay in the now.
Yeah.
Okay. And would you rather have a library full of books or a contact list full of names?
I guess probably names. That's hard for me to say because I really love books. But I think that a lot of my learning comes from interactions with others.
Yes. Well, we've had a wonderful interaction this afternoon. Thank you so much for being on MIT Talks. And I really look forward to seeing how Clover continues to grow and expand and shake up the food world.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of MIT Talks.
We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Engage with us at MIT Club of Boston's website or any of our social media channels.
Please send us your ideas for future podcast guests or reach out to further the conversation with your awesome co-hosts.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Talks.